Well, I want to thank everybody again for your attendance tonight. These events, every time I go for a gospel meeting or a lecture series, it's always a pretty busy time for me anyway. I don't know if everybody else feels like that, but it just seems like I stand up the first time and kind of turn around and it's over with. So, and sometimes that's all right. Sometimes I'm pretty ready to get home at the conclusion of a gospel meeting. But in the case of coming here to Clarksville, this is when I show up, it feels kind of like coming home. So, long time history with this area and with this place. I've got a lot of history here. One of my children was born over at the Army Hospital at Fort Campbell, and long time here, and some highs and lows in my life at this place, and so always a tender spot in my heart for the Fort Campbell area. I want to thank you for your hospitality, the elders for inviting me to come here. I appreciate it. I'm humbled when I am asked by an eldership to come, particularly when they select a given topic and ask me to speak on it. I am humbled by that, so I appreciate it. And the congregation's invitation. I appreciate your hospitality, those of you who had me into your homes. I told on the very first night, I tell people, I said, one plate per and dessert. I always want one plate and dessert. I appreciate your hospitality. I could have eaten a lot more at every table I sat at, but I'm telling you folks, when I do that, there's a reason a lot of preachers look the way they do by the time they hit 60, because I can't eat like that. I appreciate it. Your hospitality was great. The food was fantastic. The conversation and the fellowship that we had together, I appreciate it. To Hester, thank you again. This is, the Shea Cruz Bed and Breakfast is my favorite stopping location in the Nashville area. This is again kind of a second home. Hester is my adopted mother. She has helped me work through a lot of problems in my life, and Robert, her husband, was a very, very, influential man in my life as I progressed from being a boy to a man. So, I appreciate Hester's hospitality as well. If you don't know this about Hester, don't ever show up at her house to catch up on your sleep. She can survive on less sleep than any other one person that I have ever seen. We stay up and we talk and we talk and we talk and we enjoy one another's company, and I'll be exhausted when I get home tomorrow, but it's a good kind of exhausted. I am refreshed from it because I show up about every 18 months or 2 years, and she sets me back on course and sends me back home to my wife, and so that's kind of in the course of our relationship. So Hester, again, thank you very much for your hospitality. So we are going to conclude this series tonight. We have been talking about the superiority of Jesus Christ, which may seem like a blinding flash of the obvious to most Christians, but we have hopefully laid Christ and his superiority down side by side with other options that are not new. In fact, we take our text from Colossians chapter 1, or take the theme from Colossians chapter 1, and that's what Paul is asking them to consider, is the superiority of Christ to all of the other options. And the other options, you'll see this more clearly, if we take away all that, these are the options that he has left behind. And one of them that we're going to think about tonight is the option of the old law. This was a considerable issue amongst first century Christians. Not as much now, although we see it a little bit, but this was a considerable issue amongst first century Christians because, remember, that first generation of Christians were all Jews, all of them. And so, inevitably, there were great questions about, alright, where does one covenant end? Where does one covenant pick up? How do these things apply? Are we melting them together, or is it completely distinct? And so, this was a significant issue to the first century Christians, again, particularly in about the first 20 years or so. And so tonight, we're going to conclude our series with the superiority of Christ over the Noahic and the Mosaic covenant, and consider God's covenant with mankind. And so that's what we're going to think about. I think one of the one of the things, this is a basic principle of Bible hermeneutics. When you begin to interpret the Bible, one of the basic principles that, and I try to, when I sit down and study with somebody for the first time, one of the basic principles I try to convey to them is this is, there is a common thread to this book, but it's not a single covenant. There's a common thread. I do want to say that. There is a common thread, and that common thread is Christ. All right, so we get that. We understand that, but it is not a single covenant. In large terms, you know, we have always described the age of patriarchs, the Mosaic age, and the Christian age. And that's okay. Historically, we can, to some extent, divide it down like that. But the reality is there are a lot more covenants in there even than three. Because actually, during the age of the patriarchs, when God is dealing directly with individuals, there are oftentimes that the covenant is just between Him and one person. That relationship, that covenant, that agreement is just between the covenant with Noah is an example. So there are a lot of covenants in here. Now there are not a lot of laws, but there are a lot of covenants. There are several. And so we're going to think about tonight that Christ is superior to those old covenants. Now let me say, that doesn't mean that those older covenants were not divine. That doesn't mean that they weren't good. That doesn't mean that they didn't do what we talked about this morning, i.e. reflect the character of God. They did. It doesn't mean that they weren't in effect while they were. Doesn't mean that they weren't fine covenants. They were. But Christ is superior. Christ and what He has done by bringing forth and putting into effect this new covenant is superior to the older covenants. And in fact, as we will demonstrate tonight, even the people of this time, although they often missed it, even the people of the time of the Mosaic covenant in particular, were in reality, in the prophetic language, being told, being instructed, and being forewarned that someday there's going to be a new covenant. You need to be prepared to accept it. It's always been a little bit, I understand it in historical terms. I don't so much understand it in just strictly divine terms. It's always been a little shocking to me that, and this is easy to say for a person who's got the complete document and is not, you know, looking back over our shoulder. It's always been a little surprising that the Jews were not were as slow as they were to accept Jesus as the Messiah based on the Messianic prophecy. Now again, that's easy for us to say because we've got, you know, we know the end of the story. And they were kind of living. So, let's think about God's plan for a moment. God's plan for man, and we'll discuss the covenants that supported that plan. God's plan for mankind, had He not sinned. Let me just pause. If we go all the way back to Adam and Eve, God's plan for mankind, had He not sinned, in reality is not revealed. Stop and think about it. We think, we make some assumptions about it, but the reality is we're really not sure what the plan was if man had not committed sin. And in reality, let me also say, it's all academic because He did. It really doesn't make any difference what God's plan was one way or the other because the first couple committed sin and therefore God's plan had to be instituted. God did reveal His plan for mankind to respond after the introduction of sin. Psalms chapter 98 talks about the revelation of that plan to mankind. It is said in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 4 that God chose His people in Christ before the foundation of the world. The wisdom of God is manifested through His people according to the, as Paul puts it in Ephesians 3, according to the eternal purpose which He purposed in Christ Jesus our Lord. So the plan was there from the very beginning. It's important for us to recognize He had a plan. God had a plan for mankind from the very beginning. And as Paul puts it in Ephesians 1 and verse 10, the plan is summed up in Jesus Christ. That's that common thread. And so God did have a plan. There was prophetic revelation of God's plan. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, there is the first prophetic indication of God's plan, where Adam, Eve, and the serpent are being punished for what just happened there in the garden. And God makes the point to the serpent that her seed, Eve's seed, you will bruise his heel and he will bruise your head. And so there in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, we have this first prophetic concept. Now, a lot of times prophecy only becomes clear when prophecy is looked at in hindsight. I don't think, probably, that Adam and Eve fully understood what he just said, what it meant. But that doesn't make any difference for our study. The prophetic revelation to God's plan was there. To the patriarchs. In Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3, there are several promises that are made to Abraham. One of those promises is, through your seed, all of earth will be blessed. All of the population of earth, all of mankind will be blessed. Clearly, he's looking forward to Christ. And again, doubt that Abraham fully grasped everything he was saying, but that's okay. Abraham is an important character to me, an important figure to me of faith, because Abraham has made these promises, he believed them, he acted on them, and he never lived to see any of them reach fruition. Not a single one of them. And yet, he believed they would. And so, you've got that prophetic revelation of God's plan. In David, you have the prophetic revelation of God's plan. A man after my own heart, God said of David, became the archetype of a spiritual king. A king that God had planned for His people. Isaiah prophesied of the birth of Christ. Those indicators would become critically important later on. And Daniel and Amos and Hosea and the promise of the eternal kingdom, the restoration of the Davidic kingdom, and so on. And then there was the fulfillment. In Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 through 5, the Apostle Paul gives us the time brackets for the fulfillment of these promises. As he's talking to the Galatian Christians, he said, again, Galatians chapter 4, verses... It would help if I was in the right book. Galatians chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. Here in this text, Paul is talking about this fulfillment of time. The fulfillment of time occurred with the introduction of Jesus. He comes to earth. He is there. God is now manifest before us. And so you, again, have now not just the prophetic revelation of the plan, but now the plan, the pieces of the puzzle are starting together, come together. The plan is starting to come together. It's starting to be in place. The harbinger was coming, John. His birth, foretold to Zacharias, was prophetic as well. Then Jesus was born. All of those prophecies regarding Isaiah come true. We shall call His name Emmanuel, God with us. It would be in Bethlehem. He would be raised in Galilee. The interaction with Simeon and Anna just shortly after His birth. The visit of the wise men to the kings of Judah. The flight to Egypt, the return to Nazareth, His childhood, His ministry, and the list goes on. And so all of those things that Isaiah talked about, now, so understand, when we begin to look at God's covenant with man, we begin to understand that the covenant and the plan go hand in hand. God had a plan for mankind because we needed one. He revealed it in prophecy, and then in the life of Christ, the pieces start coming together and those prophecies are fulfilled, and therefore, the covenant with man is not only fulfilled, but will also change. Throughout the ages, God has defined His relationship with mankind in terms of a covenant from the very beginning. He defined His relationship with mankind, whether it was His relationship with Adam and Eve, whether it was His relationship with Abraham, whether it was His relationship with Moses or David or the apostles or us, He defined it in terms of a covenant. Although the laws within the covenant change, the fundamental relationship does not. God has always defined the covenant in the same terms. I will be your God and you will be my people. Those are the terms, that's the overall term that he used to convey the idea of the covenant relationship between Him and whoever His people were at that moment. And so we think about what a covenant is. The easiest way for us, I believe, to understand covenant with that, I have studied a little bit of the Greek. I have studied virtually none of the Hebrew. When I have to delve into the Hebrew, I have to call people who are a lot smarter than me and don't have the same accent that I have. Growing up in East Tennessee, I barely have a grasp of English, let alone Hebrew. So, but I am told this by the guys who study this kind of thing. is that the Hebrew root gives us some idea of what a covenant means. It is from the Hebrew word berith, which is most likely derived from the same root that was used to describe the chains of bondage. And so this idea is we are joined. Now, not joined in a bad way, not joined in a slave way. In other words, I don't want to be attached, or I'm here against my will, but we are attached. I want you to think of it in terms like this. You know what the concept of marriage in the New Testament of being one flesh, what does that mean? It means we're connected. That means if you try to tear us apart, you're going to take a little bit of each of us with the other one when you try to make us individuals again. And so here is this concept of an agreement or this berith. We are bound to one another. We are connected to one another. And so, I know there are a lot of folks who would like to take that, you know, that slave chain motif and apply it to their marriage, but that's not how we should look at it. It is the idea of being attached willingly, but being connected to one another, and it's not easy to break that bond. So that's what the idea of a covenant is. We would say simply, easy enough, is that it is relationship. We are connected through agreement, through relationship, and that's that in the Old Testament, New Testament, both, God has a covenant with man. He says, take a look at our first point. God's covenant with man, regardless of the age in which it happened, is characterized like this. It is summarized in that phrase, I will be your God and you shall be my people. Notice some of these passages. Exodus chapter 6 and verse 7. I will take you to me for a people and I will be to you a God. Notice that. I will take you to be a people. I will be to you a God. Remember, one of the figures that we see that describes the relationship between God and His people is a marriage. We're going to come back to that in a little while with the prophet and look at what the prophet Hosea had to say in regard to that. He says in Exodus chapter 19 and verses 4 through 6, be my own possession. Notice how he says that. Be my own possession. We have the feeling again, there is that imagery again of the marriage figure. Exodus chapter 29 and verse 45, I will dwell among you. Remember what we said last night in talking about the idea of the shepherd of a flock and that he smells like a sheep. Why? He dwells among him. That's the God's point. I'm right there with you. I am the Lord your God. Many scholars believe that that's an abbreviated form. This idea of I am the Lord your God is the abbreviated form of this covenant relationship. His manner of saying that we are in covenant relationship. We're in a covenant bond. And there are several others. Leviticus 19:2, Leviticus 26 and verse 12. And so, always characterized as, I will be your God, you will be my people. Now, there were prophetic warnings and condemnations. Jeremiah's rebuke of Israel for their violation of the covenant is pretty important for us to recognize. And so, this takes us to our scripture reading in Jeremiah chapter 7. And notice what is conveyed through the prophet Jeremiah to the people of Israel. Now remember, by this time they have fallen deep into apostasy. It is interesting when you read the prophets of the Old Testament, major or minor. Generally speaking, the news is not good. It's not like God sends prophets to them to say, you know, to build them up and give them a pep talk, you know, and say, hey, you guys are doing a great job, keep up the good work. When a prophet shows up with pen to paper, it's probably bad news. We're not being what we should. And we kind of understand that. But in Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 23, talking to his people, but this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice and I will be your God and you shall be my people. There's that key phrase again. We'll be in relationship with one another. And walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear, but followed the counsels and the dictates of their evil hearts and went backward and not forward. Since the day that your fathers came out of the land of Egypt until this day, I have even sent to you all my servants, the prophets, daily rising up early and sending them. Yet they did not obey me or incline my ear, but stiffened their neck. They did worse than their fathers. Turn over, if you would, to Matthew chapter 23 real quickly, because we're going to jump forward a few hundred years here and demonstrate that although, and I always point this out to people, and I love to study this particular period of biblical history, but I will not go into it deeply tonight. But I love to study the period of what happens to the Jews between Malachi and Matthew. There's about a 400-year period there. And when you end the book of Malachi and flip that blank page and go over to Matthew, you flip about 400 and some odd years of history. But there is a very different group of Jews in Matthew than they were in Malachi. And that's always kind of fascinated me. But what I want to demonstrate is basically what happened, although for a different reason, they have fallen away for a different reason, they're still separated from God. Because Jesus, we're going to see, says something very similar to the New Testament Jews that Jeremiah says to the Old Testament Jews before the captivity. And so in Matthew chapter 23, if you'll notice in verse 37, after really dressing down the Pharisees, I mean, the gloves are off at this point. This is during that last week before his crucifixion. The gloves are off. He lets them have it. He's very blunt, very candid. And then he laments in verse 37, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate, for I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. From the very beginning to the very end of God's relationship with Israel, this has been their case. This has been their condition, with some very short, brief exceptions. So Jeremiah is saying to them, you know what? You've always punished my servants as God's saying to the people through Jeremiah, you've always punished my servants when I've sent them to carry my message to you, and all I asked you to do was be in covenant with me. And when I did, you punished my servants. Jesus, 400 years later, is saying the same thing. The spiritual condition of the Jews was almost never any different. It was always like this. The prophet Jeremiah makes a point. They did worse than their fathers. The spiritual conditions just kept getting worse. And so, Jeremiah laments over this. There is the rebuke of Israel for the violation of that covenant. Throughout Jeremiah, God demonstrates Israel's violation of the covenant. There is the promise in Jeremiah chapter 31 of a new covenant. You have Jeremiah's rebuke in chapter 7, chapter 11, but then in chapter 31 he comes along and he prophesies a new covenant. Now we're going to come back to this a little bit later on in the book of Hebrew at the conclusion of the lesson, but he prophesies and promises to Judah and Israel there will be a new covenant. That's important. That was important for them, and I would argue that many of them, not all of them, but many of them didn't get the point of the covenant. There is a new covenant coming. And new covenant suggests that the old covenant will be no more. It will be changed. Not going to be the same covenant. If I tell you what. Let's see, my son, not long ago, I have a 1983 Dodge pickup truck that was my grandfather's, and therefore I love it. And to demonstrate how much I love my son, we kind of fixed it up and I let him drive it. I made an agreement with him. He said, Dad, I need a car. And I said, need? I said, have you got a job? And he said, no, I don't have a job, but I need a car to go to school. I'll take you. No, Dad. And I said, son, I said, I got that old pickup truck there. You can have it. I said, you pitch in. I said, how much money you got? He said, I've got $500. I said, you pitch $500 in maintenance. And I said, I'll let you drive my truck. And he drove it for a little while. Man, he complained about that truck. And he said, Dad, I need a new truck. I said, how much money you got? And he kind of hem-haws and he says, and the first thing he wants to know is, can I trade this one in? And I said, no, it's mine. Can't trade it in. He worked off a little bit. Me and Mom helped a little bit. He got a new truck. Was it the old one? Was it the same one? Nope, it was new. What's that mean? It was different. Looked different. Different VIN, different color, different size. Different engine, different everything. It was different. They were two distinct things. Wasn't a new truck. We didn't just take it down and have it refurbished and bring it back. Same old truck, new stuff on it. It was a completely new truck. It's a completely new covenant. Don't get wrapped up in this idea that is going on, that is somewhat prevalent of the one covenant, that there's only one covenant in all of the Bible. There's not. There's multiple covenants. He said, this is a new one. He gave them a promise of a new covenant. As God demonstrates Israel's rejection of the covenant, He looks forward to this new covenant. Now remember this promise again, because we're going to come back to this later on. Secondly, as we go on through the condemnation of Israel because they violated these covenants, you have Ezekiel's condemnation. Ezekiel prophesies to them at an interesting time. Ezekiel has a unique perspective. Ezekiel prophesied to the people of Judah both before and after the fall of Jerusalem and their captivity in Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. So he was warning them that it was coming. It happened because they didn't repent, and then he ministered to them during their slavery and their captivity. He has a unique perspective, and one of the things late in the book that he begins looking forward to is David, connected to this new covenant. There is condemnation, but there is also hope that there is another covenant, there is a new covenant that is down the road that is coming with coming, and we can look forward to that. Then you have Hosea's experience. Turn over to the book of Hosea. Take a look at chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. Hosea is one prophet that I always felt sorry for. Man, God gave him a tough mountain to climb. This is, if you've not worked your way through studying Hosea, take the time to do so. To demonstrate how God felt, and this goes back to this figure of marriage to describe a covenant. To demonstrate to Israel how God felt when the people of Israel turned their back on Him, He tells Hosea, I want you to take a wife of adultery. You talk about a spiritual gut check. Can you imagine if you got that instruction? I've always wondered what Noah's initial reaction was to the ark. You know, we all talk about that. But listen to the instruction. You know, Hosea, you want me to what? To demonstrate, I don't, and Hosea, bless his heart, he does it. He has his faith in God. Notice chapter 1, verse 9 and 10. There are children as a result. In verse 9, after a child is conceived, God said, call his name Lo Ammi. Now, I would always encourage people when you see names in Hebrew. You know, there is not often significance to names in our culture. You might name somebody, my grandson is named for his grandfather. And so we might name somebody after someone. But generally in linguistics, there's probably no significance to that name. In Hebrew, there almost always is. Almost always is. So when you see a name, always look at the reference and try and figure out what the name means. In this case, the name is described in that second sentence because Lo Ammi in Hebrew is, you are not my people. What's God saying? Here we have Hosea the prophet being told by God, take a woman of adultery. The woman commits adultery. There's a child that results in that. The child is born. God says, name him, not my people. What message do you think God's trying to get across to him? I mean, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out, that God is saying in all of this that He's getting ready to cut us away. He's getting ready to divorce us. He's getting ready to get rid of us because we have been unfaithful over and over and over to Him. He named the child of adultery, not my people. And so he's going to end this covenant. Paul uses Hosea's prophecy to demonstrate one aspect of the new covenant, and that is the acceptance of the Gentiles. He turns that prophecy into another context and used it in that way. So again, as we look back on this, the ancient idea of my people, your God, is not unique to one writer or one biblical age. It is spread throughout all of this. And so I want us to consider, why did Israel break the covenant with God, and how that would apply to us, and that how that can help us. First of all, we recognize they broke it. They broke it early. They broke it, as a matter of fact, while they were receiving it. They violated the covenant with God. Remember, they accepted the covenant voluntarily. They accepted the covenant enthusiastically. Multiple times. And so the fundamental problem is this. Remember that God's characterization of His covenant was, I will be your God and you will be my people. Well, how can God dwell among people who are given to sin because God is holy and righteous? Man is slow to comprehend that fundamental problem that is caused by sin. And if we maintain relationship with God, God can dwell with us because the sin is put away. God cannot dwell simultaneously with sin and unrighteousness. So if we are to dwell with Him, those things must be put out of our lives. But time and experience did not improve the situation. And so first of all, Israel broke the covenant because there was a misconception of the covenant. They didn't get it. And this is what we talked a little bit about this morning. The first thing for us to remember is that in the midst of a perverse world, God instructed His people to act in the right way. Matthew chapter 5. In the similitudes, He uses two illustrations. They misunderstood the covenant. We'll come back to that in a moment. We buy in sometimes to the idea that it's a wicked world, it's a cruel world, and I'm completely surrounded by it, and therefore, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. After all, I'm only human. If we understand the concept of this covenant as we described this morning, that this is a covenant and a law given to us that we might imitate God, and the more we imitate God, we don't have to worry about committing sin, then we don't buy into that idea. Matthew chapter 5, in the similitudes, Jesus said, use two illustrations. You are the salt of the earth and you are the light on the hill. And so there are no excuses. There are no excuses for us to go out and say, well, nothing I can do about it. They violated this covenant in this misconception because of an erroneous understanding not based on the idea of my people, your God. They believed that their obedience was a means to an end. Now listen very carefully. If you're going to take one thing from this lesson, take this. This goes hand in hand with what we talked about this morning. They saw obedience as a means to an end. You might have entered into an agreement as a child or as a parent with somebody in that relationship. Maybe as a parent you entered into an agreement with a child that said, if you do this, I'll do this. My son and I like to shoot. And we're going to try and go to a school next summer out in Arizona. And he wants to go. And I told him, I said, tell you what, you come up with the tuition to school, Dad will get you a new pistol to go to the school with. Now I said, son, don't think I'm going to blink the day before we leave for this. You ain't got tuition money, you're not going. We made an agreement. Now I'm going to tell you something. That boy's only going to raise, he's only going to raise that money as a means to an end. That's it. He's only going to obey me because he wants to go to that school. And let me say, he wants to go to that school bad. And I intend on leveraging that for everything I can get out of it. But he wants to go bad. But look, it's a means to an end to him. If it were up to him, he is like his daddy in that when he gets a dollar, he looks for someplace to spend it. But now I've got something that I can do. Here's the problem. Israel, and oh, by the way, most unfortunately Christians, look at their relationship and their obedience with God in the same way. It is a means to an end. My obedience to God is simply my ticket to heaven. It's a means to an end. I'm obeying God because, hey, look, and I can remember as a little kid, I was baptized the first time. I was baptized later. I was baptized the first time when I was 9. There had kind of been a rash of a few teenagers and kids just a little bit older than me who were baptized. And I'm sitting there, I'm 9 years old, and my dad was a hellfire hot preacher. And he kept telling me, you know, he kept saying, if you obey God, you can go to heaven. And I knew what the option was, and I was not interested in that. And I was like, all I got to do is be baptized to avoid that. I'm up for that. I'll do that. You know what? Unfortunately, that's the thought process of a lot of folks. And that's not the point. That's where Israel went awry. Obedience to God's not a means to an end. That was their misconception of the covenant. They believed that if they were obedient to God, then God was obligated to give them the blessings of eternal life. And I want to emphasize the idea that they were obligated. In other words, Lord, it is an agreement. It is a binding resolution. I kept my part, you got to keep your part. I was perfectly obedient, you owe me a seat in heaven. Folks, that's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. It's not just a means to an end. Few of them gave any thought about what their covenant to God really meant and what it required of them. When they did think of God, it was out of a slight feeling of guilt, and so for a little while they would superficially serve Him. If we consider that marriage figure that God considers both in Hosea and Malachi as God is married to His people, if we consider, and Ephesians 5 conveys that as well for Christians, we are married to, the church is married to Christ. If we look at it and we understand it in that way, if we take that figure, there are a lot of husbands and wives that don't understand the covenant they enter in marriage. When I sit and counsel a young couple, state of Tennessee will knock several dollars off of your marriage license if you'll go for counseling, premarital counseling. And so every now and then a couple wants to get married, and if I'm going to marry a couple, I tell them, you got no option. I don't care what it costs you. We're going to sit down. We're going to study the Bible about what the Bible says about marriage. And one of the first questions that I ask them is, why do you want to get married? You know what the answer is, because we're in love. To which I'd say, no, come on, really, why do you want to get married? No, seriously, why do you want to get married? What makes you think you want to spend the next 60 years with this person? You know, and that always shocks them a little bit. Well, we're in love. Well, that's great. That's good. That helps. Not going to get you all the way there, though. And so ultimately, I let them sweat for a little while. And then I say, guys, I'm not concerned about how much you love one another. I want to make sure you understand what you're doing when you stand up there, kiss, and shake hands. Because you're not standing up there with me. You're standing up there with God, and the three of you are making a covenant, an agreement. And you better understand what it means. And I'll tell you something, folks. A whole lot of folks, a whole lot of people spend more time planning their wedding than they do their marriage. That way, I've been through a couple now. Next one's the son. I don't have to pay for that one. And man, I'm going to tell him, son, have a big one. Recomp some of my food budget. But when they plan this wedding, they will spend hours and hours and hours. The photographer, the dress, the event, blah, blah. It lasts about 4 hours. She's never going to wear that dress again. You're going to, the top of that cake is going to get freezer burned in a few years. The pictures are going to get ruined in a flood because your hot water heater is going to blow up. And you spend all that effort on that one day and don't think about what happens on day two. And folks, that's where the work begins. And so when we consider it in those terms, and I ask those couples, look, we need to talk about that. Do you know what you're getting into here? Because, and I love it, you know, they'll sit there and they'll hold hands, kind of paw at each other, you know, and put their arms around each other. And I got it. You know, I was 18 once and had a young bride. I get it. I love to see them 5 years later. I love to see them about three kids later. You know, she doesn't look the same. He doesn't look the same. They've got that grimace look, you know, sometimes. Few of the Israelites understood what the covenant meant. Just like that marriage figure. Just like so many young men will come to me and say, I didn't know that's what I was supposed to do. Well, sonny, that is what you're supposed to do. That's the way it works. This is an agreement. This is a covenant. This is until death do us part. We weren't joking. This is a covenant. And Israel didn't understand that. And that misconception of the covenant, like a divorce, when a young man says, well, I didn't know that was part of the deal, and so I'm leaving, that's what happened to Israel. They didn't understand what the covenant meant, and so they said, not interested. We won't follow the covenant. That was one of the reasons why they broke the covenant. Second reason that they broke the covenant is distorted service. The Israelite worship given by God, even when it was executed, disappointed God. It was not a sweet-smelling aroma. Because they took liberty with it, and on top of that, not only did they take liberty with it, they didn't do it in the right manner, for the right reason. It became, And this is a warning to us. It became what they did on a particular day. It became what they did that day. It became the event of that day. It became ceremonial. And it was just the idea of showing up, going through the motions, and that was about, it was just that shallow. And so that distorted service caused them to violate the covenant. He rejected the Israelite attitude toward minimal service. I had a Christian ask me one time, I'm not paraphrasing, literally, what do you think the minimum number of times I need to be here is? And I'm like, you got to be kidding me, man. The minimum number? What are you talking about? Well, do I have to come on Wednesday night? Do I have to be there, you know, do I have to be there all the time? And look, I understand. We've got a lot of obligations, and sometimes those obligations collide. I get it. I understand it. Everybody's like that. And so I am not one who says, you know, boy, if the doors are open and you're not here, we're coming after you. I understand that we have those obligations in other parts of our life, other parts of our lives that God tells us we have to perform in those other parts of our lives. But that's a problem. That's going to lead somebody to just break the covenant. When you start asking, what wives, how would you like it if your husband came in and say, all right, honey, what's the minimum amount I can get out of this anniversary gift? What's the smallest amount I can spend and not be in trouble on our anniversary? Man, wouldn't that go over? That'd go over. Every husband who ever forgot an anniversary, you know how big that goes over. That's not going to work. Well, it's not going to work with God either. Israel broke the covenant, not only because of their misconception of the covenant, but that misconception led to distorted service. And finally, I want to close with this. What was God's concept of the covenant? Because this is important. This is the point. It really doesn't make any difference what their concept of the covenant, because we already saw they missed it. They missed the boat. The question is, what was God's concept of it? And so let's think about that for a moment. The problem that we discussed earlier is that God, although He sought to be Israel's God and they His people, cannot be in the presence of an unholy and an unrighteous people, and therefore He called on them to be holy. In other words, I can't be with you if you're going to be sinners, and therefore don't be sinners and I'll dwell with you. That's the answer to the problem. The book of Leviticus provides the solution. Purity through cleansing. Holiness through harmony. God taught that the Israelites must be cleansed not only from the fleshly defilement, but also from sin. And thus you have the various offerings like the sin offering, the trespass, and so on. And although final redemption would come through the Messiah, as a matter of fact, go ahead, just in the last few minutes, turn over to Hebrews chapter 9. And we're gonna study that just as our conclusion. The final redemption would come through the Messiah, but the book of Leviticus emphasized the theme of holiness through harmony with God. Harmony with God meant imitation of God in heart and in life. Leviticus taught holiness based on an imitation of God's character. We discussed that this morning in detail. But that was the idea. God can't dwell where there is sin, and therefore, to His people, if He is going to be our God, and we His people, then what that means, if He can't dwell with sin, if we want to dwell with Him and He among us, what that means is, the sin's gotta go. So what is the charge of God? Be holy. Be set apart for the service of God. Be holy, for He says, I am holy. In effect, imitate Me. Imitate His character. And so that's God's concept of the covenant. God's concept of the covenant is, this is, as we talked about this morning, this law, this covenant, these instructions are My idea about holy living. This is how I live. I'm giving it to you. This is how I want you to live. I've always been impressed. It is heartrending. But I've seen two or three examples of it where someone is ill, they're sick, they know they're probably not going to recover, and they will leave behind something for their children, either in writing or video or something like that. Now I'm going to tell you, it's hard to get through those. My heart goes out to folks that are in that situation. But I also say, it's also touching because a father is saying to them, these are My thoughts, or a mother, these are My thoughts about being a man or a woman. This is My code of conduct. Now, can't help it. I'm a big John Wayne fan. And in his very last movie, if you remember The Shootist, He says, you know, I have a code by which, you know, he passes it on to Ron Howard of all people. I didn't get it. But anyway, I'm passing this code on to you, this young boy, you know. He says, this is my code. This is the way I live. This is how I do. That's God's concept of the covenant. This is my code. This is how I want you to live. If you want to live like me and imitate me and therefore be without sin and therefore be in my presence eternally. And so Christ is superior to that old covenant. Even though this was still God's concept of that covenant, now what we find out is even that covenant, that they were supposed to have this great concept of marriage and covenant and so on, God says in the inspired writings of the book of Hebrew that now I've got something even better. This is the great text for you. I encourage people, remember this text when you ever have to discuss and study with people the distinction between Old Covenant and New Covenant. Hebrews 7, 8, 9, and 10. This is a critical text for Christians to understand. It's full of Jewish imagery for a reason, because he is appealing, the Hebrew writer is appealing to Jewish Christians because of persecution by other Jews who are considering, I need to alleviate the pain of persecution, we'll just go back and practice Judaism again if it'll get them off my back. The Hebrew writer is saying, there is nothing back there for you. Don't do that. And so in chapter 9, and again, all of this book is just full of Jewish imagery. But I do want to point a few things out for you. Remember in Jeremiah chapter 31 when we talked about this new covenant? He quotes that here in chapter 8, beginning in verse 8. He quotes that very passage. He says in verse 7, before he quotes it, that if that first covenant had been faultless, then no place would have been sought for a second. If you back up one more verse to verse 6, but now he, being Christ, has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. He continues in verse 7 that if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no place for a second covenant. Then in verse 8, he launches into the quote of Jeremiah 31 that said to the Jews at that time, there will be a new covenant. In fact, the Hebrew writer has said, remember what he said in Jeremiah 31? This is that. This is it. This is the new covenant. The new covenant he prophesied back there, this is it. And it is better. That one was great. Yes, God had a concept of that covenant that it was a marriage and it was a relationship and that you needed to hang in there and stick with it and imitate Him. It revealed His character as we talked about. But it wasn't as good as this one. This is good, or that was good, this is better, and it's better because it's based on better promises. It's better because it was ratified with better blood. And then he continued, and for the sake of time, we won't be able to see every single thing. I want to share with you chapter 9, verse 13 and 14. For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling the unclean, sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh. Now obviously that's looking back at the law of Moses. How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serving the living God. And for this reason, He is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death. It is clear, it is irrefutable, it is absolutely, we can be absolutely positive that those old covenants are divinely given. They are. God gave them to mankind. He had a certain intent, He had a certain concept when He gave those covenants, when He made those covenants. But now we have a better one. He says there is a better one. Christ is superior to the Mosaic covenant. Christ is superior to that covenant. That's the way, and you know, people have asked me to explain it further. I can't, and I don't feel compelled to. It says that it is, and therefore it is. I can't answer it more. So I don't understand exactly why God designed the old law. I've got some ideas, but that's kind of what they are. That's it. I don't know why He designed that law the way He did, and then gave us a better one instead of giving us the better one up front. Again, I got some ideas, but so it doesn't make any difference. That's the way He worked it. Now we have a better covenant. Christ is superior to the old law. Christ is superior to the old covenant. I have said over and over, I am thankful that the Lord granted me the grace to be born on this side of the cross. I think the old law would have been a tough law to live under. and it doesn't have the promise that this one does. Christ is superior to that. Put your hopes in that, not the old ones. Don't try to pick and choose and pull. We see that in the religious world all the time, where people will go back and they'll kind of pick and choose what they want from the old law and bring it forward. Look, the Apostle Paul says it in Galatians 3. You're going to keep one of it, one thing from it, you've got to keep all of it. If you want to bring back Sabbath worship, if you want to bring back all that, you're going to have to bring back animal sacrifice in the Levitical order as well. You're going to have to stone rebellious children to death. You're going to have to stone adulterers and adulteresses to death. All that goes with it. We can't pick and choose. The new covenant's a better covenant. If you're here tonight and you've never made that covenant with Christ, if you've never started that walk with Christ, you've got another opportunity tonight. You don't know that you're going to get another opportunity. This one you have seized. You have this one. If you've not become obedient to Christ, you need to begin that walk tonight. Enter into a covenant relationship and a covenant agreement with Him. Understand it properly. Understand His concept of it and live up to that. Imitate Christ in your character. And in doing so, we can have that hope of heaven. And we don't have to worry about this concept of, well, it's laborious, but I'll obey because if I don't, I'm going to get punished. That is a 10-year-old kid's way of looking at the world. And we need to be mature, spiritually and otherwise. And so if you're here and subject, we'd ask that you come while we stand and while we sing.